Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. We're currently working our way through the book of Revelation in our study of eschatology. Visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org. Now let's join our teacher, Jim McLarty.
Revelation 16. Revelation 16, starting at verse 17. There was a providential method to the madness. Last week, we took the time to talk a little bit about Hank Hanegraaff's theory of what the Great Tribulation and the Antichrist were. And we looked at his theory of the persecution that Nero wrought against the church as being perhaps the quintessential tribulation, such that every tribulation after that would be subsequent to the Great Tribulation. We looked at all that last week. Providentially. It was interesting that we brought that up last week, because what we're going to see starting tonight is the connection, historically and biblically, the connection between Babylon and a world religion that will cover the face of the earth and, according to at least King James language, fornicating with the kings of the earth. And this system coming out of Babylon is referred to with really rough language, really harsh language, as a harlot, as a whore, as a woman who commits these heinous, terrible, anti-godly acts with the kings of the earth. So we're going to see this marriage of the church and the state, and that system is called Babylon. And what I want to do tonight is introduce this Babylon concept, look at it historically out of Genesis 10 and 11 a little bit, its beginnings back there. Genesis 10 and 11, the Tower of Babel, that's the beginning of the whole Babylon concept. Do you know what Babel means to begin with? It's where God confused their languages, and it does mean confusion. The root of Babylon is confusion. And of course, you read in the Bible that God is not of confusion, that he's not the author of confusion. God has nothing to do with confusion, and yet all the way at the beginning of the book of Genesis, you've got the introduction of the concept of Babel. And all the way at the end of the book of Revelation, you've got the downfall of Babylon, whose roots are in Babel. And so this is a really important, very sweeping concept throughout the Bible that is really wrapped up in one word. It is wrapped up in the word mystery. One of the things that defines Babylon is this concept of mystery, mystery religion. If you get a chance, pick it up. You can find it on the internet now. Read Alexander Hislop's Two Babylons. And he does a great deal of connecting the dots to show you how many mystery religions out of Babylon have been carried over into modern-day religion that is coming out of Rome. And it is impossible, to my way of thinking, in the 21st century, sitting where we are now, reading the stuff that the Bible has to say in the book of Revelation about a world religion that is intermingled with world governments that sits over all the peoples of the earth, there simply is no other anti-Christian, and what I mean by that is substitute Christian religion on the face of the earth, that qualifies. If Christ is coming back anytime soon, then when he does come back, there has to be a world religion that is operating in opposition to Christianity, but doing it in such a mysterious way that is actually subjugating Christianity, acting like Christianity, wearing a cloak of Christianity, but actually speaking from Babylon and carrying on the traditions of Babylon. Did you know, let me tell you something interesting, we're going to read in a few minutes that the woman, this harlot, that written on her forehead is the phrase, Mystery Babylon the Great. Did you know that up until the 17th century, that the mitre that the Pope used to wear, you know what the mitre is, right? The fish hat, when he dresses up like Dagon, the fish god, and he puts on his fish hat. The word mystery used to be emblazoned across that mitre, so that every time he put the mitre on, he was dressed up like an ancient Babylonian god with the word mystery across his forehead. The Greek word mysterion, which is translated mystery in chapter 17, verse 5, we'll get up to it, is capitalized by the translators of the King James Version as if it's part of the title, Mystery Babylon the Great. You see it there in 17:5? But it might actually just be an adjective. It might be saying Babylon the Great, which is a mystery. In which case, Babylon the Great, starting all the way back at Babel, and going all the way to the end of the book of Revelation is just this mysterious thread that permeates all of human history and all of biblical history as a system that is the anti-God, opposite of Christianity system. You understand what I'm saying? But John Wesley wrote that this very word, and I'm quoting, this very word mystery was inscribed on the front of the Pope's mitre till some of the reformers took public notice of it. And it was only when the reformers connected those dots that they took it off, made a new mitre and took that word off there. That's from Wesley's comments on Revelation 17:5 in his explanatory notes upon the New Testament. He wrote that in 1765. And so for the last few hundred years, they've tried to kind of cover up that connection. But for, you know, 1,000 years of the papacy, the church that calls itself the Mother Church, if you've ever dealt with Catholics, they will tell you that they are the Mother Church. And that Mother Church, the head of whom is called the, are you familiar with this word, the Vicar of Christ? That is one of the titles of the Pope. What does vicar mean?
Substitute.
That's what it means. And the Pope is called the Vicar of Christ. It is said that when he sits on Peter's seat in Rome, when he speaks ex cathedra, that it is the mind of Christ speaking through him. And that's why concepts such as papal infallibility came to be, that if he is in fact the substitute for Christ on earth speaking for Christ, that he would be infallible. Whatever he spoke would be, by its very nature, unquestionable, because it is, after all, Christ speaking. My point is this. Based on everything I've already said right here, there are plenty of people out there who are going to get their hackles up and they're going to say, Jim, you're preaching against Catholicism here. Yes, yes, well, I'm Reformed. And being a Protestant Reformed guy, the Catholic Church is exactly what we were protesting and what we were, what the Reformation was all about. But after 1,000 years of the Dark Ages of the Catholic Church has only become more entrenched in its mystery religion and has not allowed any sort of reform from the inside, but instead has created brand new dogmas in the last several hundred years that were completely unknown even during the times of the Dark Ages. And if it is true, here's my point, if it is true that Christ is going to be back anytime soon, there must be a world religion that is interconnected with the kings of the earth, that sits on the sea, that is going to be identified as all the peoples of the earth. It's going to be sitting on seven hills and is going to speak for the dragon and going to be connected with Babylon in a mysterious way. All of that's what we're going to look at tonight. We may not get to all of it, but then, just to make it even more fun, I've brought all sorts of stuff tonight that we probably won't get to, so I have to come back next week and wear something other than black, and we'll cover it next week. But I've brought an article from Catholic Answers dealing with the papacy and dealing with the question of Peter and whether Peter was ever in Rome. And because they don't have any real historicity to get Peter to Rome to be the first pope as the bishop of Rome, they say flatly that Rome is Babylon. Inescapable connections that are being made. And then I will also read from Fred Zaspel, who is going to, from a Protestant view, show us that Peter might very well have been speaking of Rome when he referred to Babylon. Possibility as well. So whether you look at it from the Catholic view, whether you look at it from a Protestant view, the connections between Rome and Babylon, a city on seven hills that continues the mystery religion that began at the Tower of Babel, all of those connections at this moment in time, I'm going to say that as clearly as I can, at this moment in time, the Catholic Church just simply is, the Roman Catholic Church just simply is the leading contender to wear the title of Mystery Babylon. Now, if Christ doesn't come back for another 300 years, perhaps there is some other world religion going to rise that we don't know anything about, that hasn't appeared yet, that is going to take on that mantle. But at this moment in history, the only church that qualifies is the church at Rome. Understand? Okay. Let's start at Revelation 16 here, verse 17, and finish up this chapter, and then we'll go backwards to Genesis and work from there. The six angels have poured out their six vials. At verse 17 of chapter 16, we're looking at the seventh angel pouring out his vial into the air. And then I began to say earlier, when my brain wasn't working, that it was providentially interesting that we had mentioned the idea of the tribulation already being passed, that it happened during the time of the Neronian persecution, because these verses, 17 through 21, are going to describe events that have to do with the tribulation and the wrapping up of the tribulation, and they are described in such physical language that they have to be physical manifestations of things that take place on the earth at the end of the tribulation, and we'll be able to compare these to whether or not that all happened in 70 AD, whether or not these things actually took place back during the time of Nero. Did any of this actually occur? And if it didn't occur, then we know that Hank Hanegraaff's all wet. But, hey, we pretty much know that anyway. Okay?
Didn't you say in your blog that Nero was 54 to 68?
54 to 68 is what I'd put on the blog, right. I don't know if anybody reads my blog. The stuff that I read last week, since I didn't identify the exact period when Nero reigned, it was 54 to 68 AD. Therefore, all the other apostolic events that occurred, all of the persecution that occurred anywhere outside that time frame didn't happen under Nero's watch, therefore not connected to Nero and not connected to Hank's theory.
Did he even put that his numbers come up as 584?
No, that was funny too. I looked at another website that did the... there is a website where you can go use the Hebrew counting system. And you can put in any name. You can put in anything you want, and it'll tell you what the numeric value is. So we put in Nero Caesar, and it came up 584. Hank said it comes up 666. I'm not sure what system you got to use to come up with 666, but I took the exact words he said, come up to 666, and we used three different counting methods, didn't we, on that website? And we just couldn't get it to come up 666. However, surprisingly, Jeff Young... like 665 and a half. It was spooky. That could be the chocolate talking. Verse 17. And the seventh angel poured out his vial into the air, and there came a great voice out of the temple of heaven from the throne, saying, "It is done." You may recall that at this point, God is the only one in his temple. He's driven everyone out. He's in the temple, speaking by himself, cleansing his temple. And from the temple comes the voice of God saying, "It is done." So something has to actually be done there. For him to say, "It is done," it seems to be the end of the persecution that is going on earth, the wrapping up of the tribulation, the wrapping up of the 7 years, the wrapping up of God pouring out his wrath on the planet, except that at the same time that God is saying, "It is done," there's all these physical manifestations on the earth. Starting at verse 18, "And there were voices and thunders and lightnings, and there was a great earthquake, such as was not since men were upon the earth, so mighty an earthquake and so great." Now that says earthquake on the earth, so great it was unlike any other. Can you find an earthquake recorded in history during the time of Nero, 54 to 68 AD, that would qualify as the greatest earthquake in the history of the earth? Doesn't exist. You can go do your cross-referencing and go check. But you would think, if there had been an earthquake so big that it rattled the whole world, the greatest earthquake in the history of the earth, you'd think that at least one historian would have mentioned it. Somebody somewhere would have written about the great earthquake. But doesn't exist. Now, your other choice then is to try very, very hard to allegorize it. I don't know how, because it says earthquake on earth, greater than any. I don't know how you get rid of that language. When the horses of the Roman army were cresting the hill, it rattled the ground in such a way that the inhabitants of Jerusalem felt like it was an earthquake. I don't know what you do with it. Verse 19, "And the great city was divided into three parts." The great city there, I am convinced, is Jerusalem. We talked about that 2 weeks ago. I think it's unavoidable that the great city in that case is Jerusalem. There's only two choices for great city at that point. This is very important. Historically, at this moment, Babylon, as the city it once was, the city that it was under Nebuchadnezzar, the city that it was under Alexander the Great, the city that it was during the times of the Medo-Persians, that city doesn't exist anymore as of the time of Jesus. By the time the apostles are going out, that great walled megalopolis city has fallen into ruins and has been in ruins to this day. So kind of hard to say that in that case, Babylon is the great city. And in a moment, God is going to then say, and the cities of the nations fell, all of this because of this great earthquake. Jerusalem split into three parts. The cities of the nations fell. And great Babylon came into remembrance before God. So I think that means that Babylon can't be the great city. Babylon's being contrasted to the great city there. So you've really only got two other choices during the time that John is writing. It's either Rome or it's Jerusalem. But I think based on the evidence we saw 2 weeks ago, Jerusalem's kind of the default city. So the great city was divided into three parts. By the way, that being the case, did any writer during the time of Nero mention that Jerusalem was broken into three parts? That come up anywhere? Okay, Rome. Did any writer say that during the Nero persecution there was a great earthquake and Rome was broken into three parts? No? Well, see, then that whole theory that we looked at last week just keeps coming apart. If you just hold it up to history, the Bible, and just try to force the details into his theory, they can't be forced in there because it doesn't hold up, doesn't have any credibility. The great city was divided into three parts. The cities of the nations fell. Cities of the nations fell. At very least, that means major cities in the Middle East. If it's Jerusalem that broke into three parts because of the great earthquake, and then cities of the nations, that means outlying nations, cities in those nations came falling down. That's a huge earthquake. Seems like somebody would have written about it. But it's not there. And then great Babylon came in remembrance before God to give her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath. How harsh is that language? Now remember for a moment, like I just said, the city itself doesn't stand at that point. I'm going to read a little bit from Fred Zaspel's writing here. This is an article he wrote back in 1985, and we'll get back to it again later. One suggestion is that the Babylon that Peter writes of is the Babylon in Mesopotamia, in modern Iraq. While there's no evidence or tradition that Peter ever went east to Babylon, and that's true, there's no evidence that he went to Babylon outside of the fact that he writes that he's in Babylon. Hello? And he does, we know, go to Antioch for him to have been with Paul in Galatia. Remember, Paul writes that Peter was there? That's the place where Paul withstood him to his face. That means that Peter was outside of Jerusalem traveling and traveling into what is modern-day Turkey and those kind of areas. So it's not beyond the pale of imagination to think that he could have gone into Mesopotamia. But we don't have anything outside of his statement that he was in Babylon to show that he was in Babylon. The question cannot be settled very easily. The issue here that must be settled is whether or not Mesopotamian Babylon even existed in the second half of the first century AD. And that's a very, very important question. Did Babylon as a city exist during the period that the apostles were walking on the earth? It can be shown that it did not stand in the days of the apostles, or if it can be shown that it did not stand in the days of the apostles, then of course this cannot be Peter's Babylon. In 309 BC, Antigonus I of Macedonia leveled Babylon. Later, in 275 BC, Antiochus I took away the remaining civilian population and deported them to other cities. Pausanias, a Greek writer and geographer of the Roman period, said that there was absolutely nothing within the walls of Babylon. The city was later refounded by Antiochus Epiphanes around 160 BC, and it was later captured by the Parthians in 127 BC. In the 30s BC, this is leading right up to the time of Jesus, in the 30s BC, Hyrcanus II was in residence there for a while, and from him it is known that there was not much left to the city at that time. The Roman geographer Strabo, writing about the time of Christ, said, quote, "The great city Babylon has become a wilderness. Evidently, the Euphrates River dried up during the time of the Parthians. After that, Babylon was no more." By the way, if you look at Jeremiah 51, verses 41 to 43, go ahead and look that up, Tom. In fact, we'll let you read it. That is exactly the prediction that Jeremiah makes considering the city of Babylon. The prediction is that it will fall and that it will become completely uninhabitable. You got it over there? Jeremiah 51, 41, 42, 43.
Sheshach will be captured, the boast of the whole world seized. What a horror Babylon will be among the nations.
Notice that language right there. What a horror Babylon will be among the nations. You're going to see that in the next chapter of Revelation when she's called Mystery Babylon, the whore.
The sea will rise over Babylon. Its roaring waves will cover her. Her towns will be desolate, a dry and desert land, a land where no one lives, through which no man travels.
So there's a prediction by Jeremiah that Babylon is going to completely fall, be uninhabited, a place where no man's going to travel. And the importance of that no man traveling is that that was a great trade center. It was right there on the river. There was a lot of trade. There was a lot of luxury there. But it will become completely desolate. Continuing to read here from Fred Zaspel. From Strabo to Trajan, there is no mention of the city extant. Trajan, the Roman emperor, eager to visit the infamous Babylon, was disappointed when he arrived at the site. It was only a wasted pile of rubble. The importance of that history and why I bring it up, he brings it up in the context of questioning whether Peter was in Rome or in Babylon. We're going to get to that question in a bit. Why we're interested in it at this moment is, if Revelation is written for the time we live in or a time in the future, one of two things has to be true. Either Babylon, the city, has to be rebuilt to its former splendor so that it can be torn down again, or else the Babylon we're talking about here is not a physical place in Iraq. If it's not a physical place in Iraq, and yet is referred to as a city, as a locatable city, like a city on seven hills, which it's about to be called, then Babylon, Mystery Babylon, whatever Mystery Babylon entails, is a system as well as a city, and it's not the city in Mesopotamia. It's a city that has moved somewhere else, and the reformers all argued it's Rome. Got all that? So when we read that the great Babylon came in remembrance before God, when John was writing this, AD 92, 96, somewhere in there, Babylon as a city was an empty waste. So is that the Babylon that came into remembrance for God? Or is it the mystery Babylon, that whole system of anti-God religion started all the way back at Babel and kept alive in every anti-Christian religion in the history of the world that came up in God's remembrance? And based on all of the typology and all of the figures we're going to see in chapter 17, I'm more prone to understand it that way. That what God remembered here was from all the way Tower of Babel, all the way to the end of time, that system of anti-God religion that makes up Mystery Babylon, which is why it's Mystery Babylon. Now, if you want to argue that it's the place, that it's a locatable place, and if you want to argue that Peter actually, when he wrote that he was in Babylon, you know me, I'm a raging literalist wherever you can be literal. But as Fred points out, there's no history of a church in Mesopotamia. But more importantly, whether you can prove he was there or he wasn't there, even the Catholics in a moment are going to connect Babylon and Rome. And that's what I want you to get out of this. That connection between Mystery Babylon and Rome on Seven Hills, that connection turns up over and over again, and even the Catholics can't avoid it.
He would also be pouring his wrath on a city that's in ruins, which is kind of redundant.
Right, that's why I'm saying, you know, there was a lot of hubbub during the time 10 years ago, 13 years ago, when Saddam Hussein wanted to rebuild Babylon. That was one of his goals. And he actually put out a series of coins that on one side had his inscription and on the other side had Nebuchadnezzar's inscription because he was going to rebuild Babylon and be the king of Babylon. But God didn't let that happen. But for all the prophecy writers, that was pretty exciting for a moment. Say, hey, Babylon's being rebuilt. Well, then you can rethink all of your eschatological charts, you know, and say, wait, there might actually be a Babylon, a physical Babylon to deal with, but at this moment there still isn't one. And again, when we get to chapter 17, it's not necessary that there be a physical one. It seems to have been located elsewhere. So the great Babylon came in remembrance before God, and this is the reason it came to his remembrance, to give unto her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath. God said, okay, that's done. I'm done with pouring out my wrath, the 7-year tribulation. Now I'm going to concentrate on Mystery Babylon. That's the focus now of God's wrath. And every island fled away, and the mountains were not found, apparently still the results of this earthquake. So islands are being flooded, mountains are being flattened. So far, nobody's written about it. So I say again, has to be a future event. And the physicality of it, I just don't know how you interpret those verses in any sort of allegorical way. Unless you say, like, the islands were the apostles, and the apostles fled away, and then, see, you end up there. Verse 21, and there fell upon men a great hail out of heaven, every stone about the weight of a talent. And here's the third time you see it in this chapter, and men blasphemed God. The third time, John says in this chapter, that as God pours out his wrath, as God pours out his punishment, men do not repent, they don't turn, they don't choose, they don't make him Lord and Savior, they don't do anything positive. All they do is continue in their anger and they blaspheme God, recognizing that it is God that is the source of all the wrath that's coming their way. So they blaspheme God because of the plague of the hail, for the plague thereof was exceeding great. Okay, hail, what have you got for interpretations of talent? What do you got for size? Anybody got a footnote?
We got 100 pounds.
You got 100 pounds.
Yeah.
And you got a pound? You got 100 pounds. Okay. 100 pound hail. Let's go with that. 100 pound hail falling from the sky.
Stones, not hail.
Well, it's hailing stones, right, sure. But doesn't it seem like if 100 pound stones fell from the sky, somebody would have mentioned it? Wow, what a summer we had. I mean, somebody would have mentioned. Wow, what strange weather. You know, 100-pound stones from the sky, no mention of it. That takes us to chapter 17, verse 1. And there came one of the seven angels, which had the seven vials, and talked with me, saying unto me, come here, I will show unto you the judgment of the great whore that sits upon many waters. Now, that is a direct connection. Remember that there's no chapter divisions in John's writing. We've just heard that Babylon came into remembrance before God to give unto her, Babylon is stated now in the feminine, to give unto her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath. Then the angel says, come here and I'll show you the judgment of the great whore that sits upon many waters. That great whore is Babylon. All the way through the Old Testament, God likens chasing after foreign gods to whoredom. This is consistent language all the way through the Old Testament. God talks about sinning Israel, Caesar has two sisters in Egypt, Ahola and Aholibah, and that they go chasing after their lovers. And it's always that language of whoredom, of prostitution, of illicit lovers, of cheating on their husband. That language is consistent. So when we see this language here of Babylon being a whore, we should immediately think in Old Testament Jewish language. Again, very Jewish phraseology here. Throughout the Old Testament, this language of whoredom has to do with worshiping other gods other than Yahweh, other than the God of Israel, other than the God that is God, the I Am. So come and I will show you the judgment of the great whore that sits upon many waters. In a moment, the angel's going to interpret for us, which is very helpful, and tell us that the many waters are all the peoples of the earth. We don't have to go through a lot of trouble to figure that one out. With whom, verse 2, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication. So the language is that there's this unclean woman, this unclean prostitute, and she has committed her whoredoms with all the kings of the earth. That is that connection of governmental authority, kingship, and religion. And the greatest tragedies that have happened in human history have all happened as a direct result of the intermingling of church and state. It's one of the reasons that the founders of America, the founders of the United States, on purpose in the founding document, in the Declaration of Independence, made sure to say that the government would not be responsible for establishing any religion, because they were coming from King George, and they were coming from the fact that the king was the head of the Church of England, and that the king could use his civil authority to drive you to accept his ecclesiastical authority. And of course, the English kings got that directly from the Pope when Henry VIII broke off from the Catholic Church so that he could divorce his first wife and then get a second and a third and sixth. The Pope said, no, you can't do that, essentially. And he said, well, I'll show you, and basically started his own church. Threw the Catholics out and said, Church of England, and then made up his own rules. But he still continued the same ecclesiastical methodology that he had learned from Rome, which was combination of church and state. And so that's why the early Roman emperors were also the head of the Roman church. And even now, the papacy is the head of its own city. That's why it has Vatican City, completely independent of every other civil authority. They have the complete right to make and create their own laws, and they have a seat at the United Nations as an independent entity. So, thinking historically, could things like the Spanish Inquisition, could that have taken place had it not been for the intermingling of church and state? No, because a church on its own wouldn't have the civil authority to put people to death. But as soon as you get the throne and the papacy connected, you're burning people at the stake. The biggest problem, well, not the biggest, but among the biggest problems with Islam is its connection to the church and state, which is why Islamic nations are able to use the sword or the bomb or the airplane in the promotion of their religion, because there is no civil authority that is going to impose laws or rules against the ecclesiastical authority. They're going to work in tandem, and next thing you know, it's agree with me or die. And that's what the problem with this final church is, that Babylon is going to be committing her whoredoms with the kings of the earth. There's going to be that interconnection. Did anybody watch when Pope John Paul, the last time he was in America, and Bill Clinton was there when the Pope was up on the riser, on the platform? Did anybody watch any of this stuff? There is a covenant, an agreement, wherever the Pope is, that when he is sitting in his throne, when he's sitting on his chair on a platform, no one's head can be higher than his. And Clinton sat lower than he did. He sat at the center of the stage, raised up. The president was down here. The leaders of the nation were down here. But the head of the church was up higher than all the rest. And of course, anywhere in the world that he goes, the kings of the earth can't wait. Do you really think that George Bush would ever make a public comment against the see at Rome? No, of course not. Is he Catholic?
No.
Then why won't he make a public comment against the see at Rome?
Doesn't want to stick his nose into it. He doesn't want to get
right.
in trouble.
Because of the political backlash that would come his way if he ever spoke against Rome, because Rome has that sword to wield. And there would be such a political backlash that it's not worth it. To whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication. Now look, notice that God did not say that they created covenants or agreements or convenient, helpful associations. He said that when the kings of the earth made these agreements and participated in this false church and helped it promote its and establish its doctrine and authority on the earth, it was whoredom. You get that? From God's perspective, this intermingling of the church and state is a terrible thing. And remember, at the beginning of the book of Revelation, we read Jesus say that there was a certain doctrine that he hated. Remember what it was? The doctrine of the Nicolaitans. Nico means conquer. Conquer the laity is basically how that word comes out, the Nicolaitans. That if you have a higher echelon within the church, the high and mighty clergy, that can then impose its will on the conscience of the laity, it is a way of conquering the laity through the clergy. Now, every false religion has at its core that kind of pyramid-shaped, and you can really look at this in most cults, it has that pyramid-shaped management style where there's the one guy at the top who calls all the shots, and the bottom layer is all the people who have to do whatever the guy at the top says for them to do. Just follow me, do what I say, don't question it, carry on. From that, if you just say that that is a defining characteristic of cults, then put at the top of that pyramid, I don't know, a pope. And then directly under him, a bunch of cardinals. And then directly under him, bishops in certain areas. And directly under him, priests. And then all of the laity have to come to those priests and confess all their personal sins, which, by the way, gives the local priest a great deal of power over you and your conscience if he knows all the bad stuff you've ever done, and then has the right to tell you how much it's going to cost you to get out of purgatory, give more money, say more Hail Marys, do all that. He has successfully invaded your conscience, and he has then become the intermediary between you and Christ, you and God. He becomes the voice of the conscience of the church, and he invades your conscience to tell you what you have to do to make it right with God again. But God says that kind of doctrine he hates.
Side note, Jim, did you know that reading Steve Campbell, I'm talking about how the new Pope for World Youth Day issued an indulgence to, he's bringing that stuff back up, him being like over there for doctrine. He issued an indulgence for any youth who would attend the World Youth Day.
Really?
Especially stay through the end, and then he offered a partial indulgence if you weren't able to come, but in you know, wherever you were, that you prayed for the church, prayed for him, prayed for the promulgation of the faith. So,
and what exactly, what was Luther's 95 thesis against?
The
selling of indulgences. So the new Pope is giving indulgences to anybody who will come to Youth Day. You get a full indulgence if you stay the whole time. The only thing we've learned from history is that we haven't learned anything from history. Yeah. It just keeps repeating itself. To whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. Can you lighten up a little, God? Gee. I mean, what harsh language. Now, does that imply to you that there is, at very least, a system, I'd go so far as to say a religious system, that God is absolutely opposed to? Because if we can say that God is categorically opposed to certain religious ideas, then that whole notion that there are many pathways to God and many religions and many different ways, the same way that all of humanity is broken down into two groups, it's black and white, it's either children of God or children of the devil. It's either children of light or children of darkness. It's either those who are elect or it's those that are eternally condemned. Those are the two. It's either those that believe in Christ and are saved or those who don't believe and are damned. I mean, all of humanity is broken down that way. Consequently, if that's true, that all of humanity can be broken down into two categories, then all the religions of men can also be broken down into two categories. The religion of light, the religion of truth, that says I am the way, the truth, and the life, the only religion, Christianity, that has proof where its leader, who was God incarnate, proved himself by getting up out of the grave, who actually offered tangible, physical, historical proof of the validity of his claims, and then you have all the other religions of the world. And all those other religions of the world fall under the category of Babylon mystery religion, because they all are anti-truth, anti-Christian, anti what is right and godly, and the religion historically of Yahweh. Everything else is not true, not the truth, substitute of the truth. Therefore, this verse says that everybody who's part of those religions is not looked on by God as pitiable, as people just doing the best they can, as people who are really sincere, and therefore God will take their sincerity into account. And listen, the guys who flew planes into buildings were really sincere, committed to what they believed, but it didn't make it right. And when you've got God saying things like, the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the inhabitants of the earth are made drunk with the wine of her fornication, that's not pleasant language where all those other religions are concerned. And so again, you have to say that God is very, very exclusive and not willing to just kind of be broad-minded and open-minded, choose a pathway to God. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness. I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast, full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color, and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand, full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. So she's got this cup in her hand, full of the fornications with which the world has become drunk. Now, by the way, there are ancient wood carvings, there are ancient relief sculptures of Ishtar, Semiramis, the one called the Mother of God. And she almost always has a golden cup in her hand. And she very often is riding on the back of a beast, which is really interesting. But if that's true, then ancient Babylonian Semiramis Ishtar worship can be identified one more time as being right here. This woman sitting on a beast, having that golden cup of the abominations with which she has made the whole world drunk. And when you get a hold of that, again, it makes it very difficult to use the word Easter in the spring, or even Christmas, because it's all part of that system that God has spoken so vehemently against right here. So verse 5, upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with great astonishment. Now, starting at verse 7, which we'll pick up next week, we're going to have an interpretation from the angel of what all that means. But I want to get to Genesis real quick tonight, just so we can do the bookends here. But one of the things that is identifying this Mystery Babylon character is that in this cup she is drunk with the blood of the saints. She has always been against the saints, the Hagios, the true church, the elect of God. She has always been in opposition to them and is responsible for the killing of the saints, and I would argue in this case, since Christ forward. Christ has already talked about how Jerusalem was responsible, and the leaders of Jerusalem were responsible for all the blood of all the prophets, from righteous Abel all the way up to Zacharias, who was killed in the temple. But now we've had 2,000 years of persecution in the church. And where did the persecution of the church really begin? Where was its locus? Where was it most focused? Rome. You're back in Rome again. You're back there dealing with it, and it's a persecution that has continued up until, I would argue, even up until Hitler, which to this day the Catholic Church has yet to ever castigate Hitler. Hitler died a good Catholic. Get used to it. That would have been, in the killing of Jews, the killing of saints in the way that we have seen the word saints used all the way through the book of Revelation, God's elect chosen people. Now, whether you're talking about persecution against the Anabaptists, go back and read, what's the book, The Reformation and Her Stepchildren. I have it. I'll bring it if anybody's interested in it. That talks about the history of the Anabaptists and the persecution at the hands of Rome. Certainly the Reformers were persecuted. Certainly Christians down through the ages. We've already talked about the Spanish Inquisition. There's a whole lot of persecution that Rome is directly responsible for, that John Paul took the time to try to apologize for. What was he out there apologizing for? Remember when John Paul II was out there apologizing for the things the Roman church had ever done? Well, if their hands were clean, there'd be no point to all these apologies he kept issuing to all the people that they were ever responsible for persecuting. So once again, the connection's unavoidable. Turn back to Genesis 10 real quick. Starting at verse 8, we're talking about the descendants of Noah here. This is Noah's genealogy, family record. Starting at verse 8, Cush begat Nimrod. He began to be a mighty man in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. So we're basically 3-4 generations from Noah here. This is very, very early on. God has flooded the earth, killed everybody but Noah and his descendants. 8 people kept alive. And then you start the descendants of Noah, and right away, Babel shows up. Now turn to chapter 11. Verse 1, and the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. And it came to pass as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. And they said one to another, go to, let us make brick and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone, and they had slime for mortar. And they said, go to, let us build us a city and a tower whose top may reach unto heaven, and let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the earth. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of men built. And the Lord said, behold, the people are one, and they have all one language, and this they begin to do, and now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. Go to, let us go down, and there confound their languages, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build the city. Therefore the name of that place is called Babel, or confusion, because God there did confound the languages of the earth. And from thence did the Lord scatter them abroad upon the face of the earth. Basically what you're reading here is that human beings were no better after the flood than they were before the flood. God brought the flood because every imagination of their heart was only evil continually. And he said, my spirit will not always strive with man. And he finally said, that's it. And he wiped out everybody. And then naturally, if everybody sprang from the eight people that were on the boat, they would speak one language. That's completely consistent. And then as they grew and spread out with one language, they decided, well, that continual wickedness of their hearts, let's build us a tower. Let's build a tower, it says here, that reaches up to heaven. There's a lot of controversy about what that really meant. However, history, all over the world history, you see a lot of ziggurats. You know what those are? Pyramids that are stair-stepped. Yeah. And almost invariably at the top of those things, when you read tower here, it may not be what we think of like a cylindrical tower. It could very well have been a stair-step ziggurat-type tower that reached higher and higher and higher. And on all of those, whether you find them in South America or whether you go over in the Middle East, where there are plenty of them, at the top, there are a lot of zodiac signs, the whole point being that they were used for astronomical configurations and figuring out the movement of the stars, and they always had astronomical connections, as like even the pyramid in the Tower of Giza or Stonehenge. All of those appear to have astronomical connections, connections to the heavens, connections to the stars in the heavens. So whether or not they were actually trying to build a tower that would reach to quote unquote heaven, I think what they were saying was a tower that would reach up into the skies, and then at the top of it, if it's consistent with everything else we've seen historically, there would have been zodiac signs and the beginning of the worshiping that Paul talks about in Romans 1 and 2, where he says that men began to worship the creature rather than the creator, that part of the wickedness and the evil of men was that they started to see everything that he had created in the heavens and started worshiping the heavens instead of worshiping the God who created the heavens. So whatever it was that happened at Babel, they built some kind of tower, some kind of structure that was very high and that was connected with their desire to be like God and their desire to have some kind of control or understanding of the heavens and their desire to push off God's control and be in control. They said, let us make a name for ourselves. It's a way of saying, let us be great. Let it be about us instead of about God. The beginning of a religion that says, push God off, let's build a tower, and let's make ourselves the object of our own worship. And the beginning of worshiping the creature rather than the creator. Now that's the beginning of Babel and Babylon. And next week, as we begin to interpret this beast with seven heads, which won't be too difficult with all the background work we've done now, and as we look at this woman and the interpretation of this woman, it's going to become clear pretty quickly that she is a religious system that has apparently existed since all the way back at Babel. She's mysterious, she's anti-God, and everything about her is repugnant to God. And yet, she is intimately connected with the kings of the earth. And there is this interrelationship and interplay between the governments of the earth and this world religion, and yet God absolutely hates and detests it and calls it the most repugnant language he can think of. And I just can't help the fact that the leading contender at this moment in time is Rome. And next week we'll see that she's located on seven hills. He's going to say the seven heads she's riding on are seven hills. There's only one place in the world called the City on Seven Hills. I mean, these are just too coincidental. And like I said, I advocate that you read Two Babylons, Hyslop's book. If only a quarter of what he says can be validated, it's still overwhelming. And so, pardon me?
Who is that written by?
Alexander Hislop, H-Y-S-L-O-P, Hislop. Alexander. You can find it online now. It's dry reading. It's academic, but it's very interesting. And the reason that it's called Two Babylons is because he's making the connection between ancient Babylon and modern-day Rome, as did one of my favorite books on Reformed theology is Lorraine Bettner's book on the Reformed doctrine of predestination. Big, thick book. Well, he also wrote a book on Catholicism. And in it, he makes many of the same connections that Hislop does. There is no other leading world religion connected to the kings of the earth and the governments of the earth that is directly connected to the mystery religions that rose out of Babylon. The Catholic Church is the only contender. If you know of another one, please tell me. If you know of another religious organization that could rightly be said to have the same power and authority as the Catholic Church over all the nations of the earth and be directly, from a religious standpoint, connected to the mysteries of Babylon, tell me the other contender, because I'm not aware of one. Islam?
Well, see, the thing is that there's so many things that Islam has in common with Catholicism that some of the ecumenical efforts that they want to extend, that their God is the same as Allah, and that, you know, there's just a lot of potential there.
I agree with that, but one of the things that the false prophet is going to do as a leading religious head is going to be to help that ecumenical movement to see all religions as one religion leading toward God, especially considering that the Christian church, the true church, is gone. So yes, those connections exist, but can you say that there is a seat of authority, an Islamic seat of authority, that has connection with all the governments in the world with any kind of real sway?
OPEC?
You know? That's a coalition of corporations that move oil around. I mean, you look at the seat at Rome.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I would put it this way. Find me an Islamic equivalent to the seat at Rome.
Soon.
It could exist, but it doesn't yet. Yeah.
And this couldn't just be a general anti-Christian view, because Hindus and Islam and Buddhism, all those, you can definitely see Babylon mystery religion in every
sure.
single one.
Is there anything mysterious about, you know, a blue elephant god with two heads?
Yeah.
And that is...
There are no Christian countries that are direct Christian, but so every king of the nations have all been connected with
right.
some Babylon mystery religion.
Right.
It's all about...
Every nation that's ever had a king has been connected to some mystery religion.
Yes. Yep.
America is the first nation in the history of the world that began with the concept of the government not controlling religion, despite the fact that those days are ticking down now, too. Okay, so I know that's real heavy stuff. Next week, I will read for you from Catholic Answers, and it's really interesting to watch even the Catholics go through their machinations to try to explain their approach to the book of Revelation is, don't read it. That's just their whole approach. It's just, no, don't read it. No, you can't understand it. We lost the decoder ring. Nobody knows. It can't be understood. That and Daniel, just don't read them. Because they understand that the connection to Rome is just too undeniable. So, anything else? Okay.
Thank you for joining us for this week's study. We invite you back next week for another Salvation by Grace message.